We've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Your future self will thank you. Go to kachava.com and use code Pandora for 15% off your next order. That's Kachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code Pandora.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome to the 325th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are a review of Patrick's weekend predictions, a look at week 10 of college football action and week 9 in the NFL, a quick recap of the last week in the NBA, and another recap, this one, of the end of a fantastic World Series. Let's jump right in with a look at Patrick's weekend predictions, and we will start in college football, where Patrick went 2-2 with his weekend predictions. In the NFL, Patrick went 3-1, and in his first NBA predictions of the year, Patrick went 2-2. That means his overall record this week was 7-5, and his overall record all time is 1,365-857. That's a 61.4% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, it wasn't my first predictions of the season in the NBA. It was my second week, but still not doing too great in those, only 2-2 this week. Some close games there. The Bucks beat the Warriors 120-110, which I got wrong. The Spurs beat the Heat 107-101, which I got right. The Bulls beat the Knicks 135-125, which I got wrong. That was NBA Cup action. Then the Pistons beat the Mavericks 122-110. I think that was the Mexico City game this year, which I got right. So doing okay, but, you know, better than the 1-3 first week. I typically get better with those predictions as the season goes on. So hopefully that continues. In the NFL, it certainly has, where, as you said, I went 3-1. The Steelers beat the Colts 27-20. Which I got wrong, but the rest of the predictions I got right. The Broncos beat the Texans 18-15. The Bills beat the Chiefs 28-21. The Seahawks beat the Commanders 38-14. So good week there in NFL predictions. And then in college football, Texas beat Vanderbilt 34-31. I tried to get tricky and pick a road underdog there, and I got it wrong. You know, Texas, that was really the first game that Arch Manning has played where I could say that he played really good. So that was part of it. But then number 18, Oklahoma beat number 14, Tennessee, 33-27. That one I got wrong as well. But the other games, number 24, Utah beat number 17, Cincinnati, 45-14. Got that right. And North Texas beat Navy 31-17. I also got that right. So overall, a decent week. Happy to be above 500. But looking for a better week, especially in the NBA soon.
Yeah, and my apologies. It was the first week of predictions for a podcast that I've actually hosted. I missed last week, so that's why I missed that Patrick had done it before. All right. Well, as always, Patrick's predictions for the weekend games will be posted on our social media handles on Thursdays. Those social media handles are 4th and 24. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24. Let's now turn our attention to a look back at week 10 in college football.
Starting with USC, who beat Nebraska 21-17. This game, really, Nebraska had a few points where they probably could have capitalized and won the game, but they did not capitalize, and USC instead won. I'm thinking specifically about when Nebraska had the ball in USC territory. I think they were up 14-6 at this point and had a chance to go down there and score a touchdown, but instead Dylan Raiola turned the ball over and got injured, and USC got the ball back, scored a touchdown to tie the game, and Raiola was out for the rest of the game. So very, very big swings in that game, I guess. Maybe not missed opportunities, probably not the right word. But USC, regardless, they moved to 6-2. They're doing pretty well this season, 4-1 in the Big Ten. I don't know if that's going to be good enough to be a Big Ten championship game team, as there are a lot of I think there are still two or three undefeated teams in the conference, but they are still winning games. They should still be happy about their season, still very much in the playoff discussion. Speaking of the playoff discussion, West Virginia beat number 22 Houston 45-35. So Houston kind of taking themselves out of that discussion with a terrible loss. West Virginia 0-5 in the Big 12 heading into that week, 3-6 overall now, even after that win. But Houston was 7-1, 4-1 in the Big 12. So just a big surprising loss for Houston to take so early in the year. I mean, this is not something that you would expect them to do at all, because they have just, you know, they've rolled through a pretty easy schedule. And they've been kind of the underdog story, in the sense that no one has really paid attention to them until they got to 7-1 after beating Arizona State. But then, of course, as soon as they get that status, as soon as they get nationally ranked, and some attention shifts to them, they just immediately lose to one of the worst teams, if not the worst team on their schedule. Even though they had four easily winnable games left on their calendar, they've already lost one of them. So who's to say they're going to win the other two? The other three. Then you have number 24, Utah, who beat number 17, Cincinnati, 45-14. Utah just flat out dominated Cincinnati. Cincinnati was due for a Big 12 loss. I think you could just go by the fact that they played a pretty even game with Nebraska and lost with them at the beginning of the season, and say that how many teams are better in the Big 12 than Nebraska? And I think the answer is probably at least four or five. And Cincinnati just hadn't played any of those teams yet. But now that they have, it was kind of expected that they'd, you know, have a little regression, lose in one of those games. I mean, I still think they have BYU and Texas Tech somewhere on their schedule looming. So, or at least one of them, I'm going to check right now who it actually is. They do actually, yeah, they have BYU in 2 weeks. So we'll see if they can deal with that. They have a bye week before playing Arizona right now. So they have some time to recover, and we'll see what happens. They're still one of the top three teams in the Big 12, according to the standings, at least. As BYU is at 5-0, Texas Tech at 5-1, and Cincinnati also at 5-1. Of course, very important, BYU plays Texas Tech next weekend. So that will go a long way towards deciding those standings, for sure. But number 15, Virginia, beat Cal 31-21. Virginia still undefeated in the ACC at 8-1 overall. Just a great season for them. This was a mild challenge, but they were able to meet it. Obviously, traveling across the country is just kind of an issue. So, you know, there are a lot of things that could go wrong when you're doing that. But Virginia able to kind of just deal with all of the different aspects that that involves, and get the victory on the road. Then you have one of the games I mentioned in my weekend predictions. Number 18, Oklahoma, beat number 14, Tennessee, 33-27. Also, in the predictions aspect of this, I thought about picking Oklahoma because I think they are just the better team than Tennessee. And I haven't really been convinced that Tennessee is very good all year. But Oklahoma last week also didn't look very good against Ole Miss, looked very stagnant on offense. So despite Tennessee's weak defense, I thought Oklahoma was stagnant enough on offense, really since Mateer returning from his injury, that they wouldn't have enough to win this game. That would probably end up being a shootout. And I guess their defense stepped up enough to keep Tennessee at a respectable point value, and then Oklahoma scored enough of its own to end up with the victory, basically all off the lead they took in the first half. The 16-10 lead at the half was the exact score of the, or the exact margin of victory that they ended the game with. So Oklahoma doing a good job going on the road, beating Tennessee. Doesn't get any easier, though. They have to go on the road and play Alabama this week. So not a lot of rest in that schedule. Or sorry, not this week, but the week after Alabama playing LSU this week. Oklahoma is on bye, but their next game is Alabama on the road, and then they have Missouri at home and LSU at home, which, you know, maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago people would consider a tough stretch, but at this point neither of those two teams look very good. So should be an easier stretch for them to end the season, but they have, you know, gone through what was originally five ranked games in a row, and they're 1-1 so far in those two games, including one road win. So, you know, we'll see what happens with Oklahoma. I think they'd be an interesting team for the argument of the 9-3 team making it or not making it, because they'd only have losses to Texas, Ole Miss, and Alabama. I would be projecting that to be a loss, which would mean they'd probably end up losing to three top five SEC teams that combined would have, I don't know, maybe three or four conference losses. And then meanwhile, they have a win over Michigan, who obviously is in the top 25. Win over Tennessee, who undeservedly so, but is still in the top 25 for whatever reason. And then probably a win over a Missouri team that for some reason might also hang on to a top 25 spot, even though they probably don't deserve it. But, you know, we'll see what happens in that game. That's projecting way too far. Also, there's a lot of moving parts related to that, especially when you consider a team like Texas Tech, who's number 13 in the country heading into the week. Ended up number 11, I think, or number 9 in the recent poll or in the current poll. They're 8-1 now, 5-1 in the Big 12 after a demolition of Kansas State. Kansas State started out this game up 7-0 after the first quarter. Texas Tech proceeded to go on a, if you want to use basketball terms, because it's basketball season now, a 43-13 run to end the game. It's just unbelievable what this team can do in terms of putting up points in a hurry. Especially when they need to, and they were able to do that, especially when they're fully healthy too. Baron Morton playing in this game as opposed to Will Hammond in some other games and some of the most important games of the year too. Not saying that he's bad because he's won them those games anyway, but just, you know, not the same having your backup quarterback than it is having your starter. And then speaking of a team that, you know, in conference realignment, you'd think that they joined the Big 12, but they joined the ACC. SMU, they beat Miami in overtime 26-20. So the Hurricanes fall for the second time in the ACC season. Very unlikely at this point in the year that they would compete for an ACC title just based on the way that the schedules have shaked out in a lot of different teams' favors, including the fact that Virginia is still undefeated. SMU, as we just talked about, they only have one loss. Also, they have the tiebreaker over Miami by virtue of beating them last weekend. You also have Georgia Tech, who has one loss, Pitt, who has one loss, Louisville, who has one loss, Duke, who has one loss. So good luck to Miami in terms of making it into that conversation when there are six teams ahead of them in the standings, and they don't play a single one of them other than Pitt. So I don't know how Miami is going to make it back in to the ACC title discussion. And frankly, I don't know if 10-2 with what they've done this season will be enough because they don't really play anybody for the rest of the year. They just have to hope that Pitt ends up ranked before that game, which they are 7-2 and 5-1 in conference. So it isn't crazy to think about that. But maybe if Pitt ends up ranked and that becomes a ranked win for them on the road, then maybe they'd be in the discussion there at 10-2. But then you have number 20 Texas, who beat number 9 Vanderbilt 34-31. Talked about it in predictions a little bit, but Texas really just dominated the beginning of this game. And Vanderbilt had no chance to really mount a comeback. Texas up 17-0 after the first quarter, 24-10 after the first half, and 34-10 after the first three quarters. Vandy did score 21 unanswered, though, in the fourth quarter. And they had a chance to field the onside kick, and it actually went out of bounds. They almost did recover it, and then they would have needed a field goal to force overtime. And we would have been talking about one of the greatest comebacks of all time. But instead, onside kick goes out of bounds. Texas gets the victory. And it's a little bit less interesting to talk about. But going back to some very, very fun games, NC State beat Georgia Tech 48-36. So Georgia Tech finally suffers its first loss of the season at the hands of the Wolfpack, who, funny enough, I think are also Virginia's only loss of the season, too. So even though that wasn't in a conference game, technically, as we've noted before. But yes, NC State has beaten Virginia and Georgia Tech this season. Just kind of funny because those two teams have one loss each, and it's to a team that's 2-3 in the ACC and 5-4 overall. So NC State, giant killers that don't take care of business in between their biggest games. But you know what? They will take the fact that they're one win away from bowl eligibility because everybody thought they were going to be pretty bad this year. So they'll take that. But then you have number 5, Georgia, who who, of course, will play Georgia Tech later this season. But Georgia is now 7-1 on the year after a close win over Florida, 24-20. This is kind of the Florida playbook. I mean, they're going to play everybody somewhat close. If you're a really, really great team, you probably can beat them by two or three possessions, but not necessarily very common. They're good enough to just stay in games. And Georgia's style this whole year has kind of been to stay in a game and then wear the other team out in the second half, and that's when they really start to take advantage of their pieces. So this is a typical Georgia game, to be honest with you. They were down 10-7 and then ended up 10-10 at the half and took control of the game in the second half. Pretty normal. And speaking of taking control in the second half, Penn State put up a fight at Ohio State. Well, for a half they did. It was 17-14 at the half, so Penn State keeping it kind of close. And then, well, the second half happened. Ohio State exploded for 21 unanswered, and Penn State had absolutely no chance. Although, of course, this was the game that in the preseason was supposed to be, a Big Ten championship game spot on the line. But obviously, the way that Penn State's season has unfolded, not even close. It's just Ohio State trying to battle to stay undefeated while Penn State looks to notch their first conference win. And at this point, looking like they won't even make a bowl game. So two seasons going in completely opposite directions. Julian Sands soaring towards being maybe the Heisman favorite, if not at least in the conversation. Meanwhile, Penn State just still can't find a win.
Yeah, I think Julian Sands actually is now the Heisman favorite, as strange as that sounds. And Penn State's next supposed to be marquee matchup is coming up this weekend against Indiana. So don't know if they're going to get that conference win this weekend. All right, that wraps up our look at college football for this week. Let's move on with a look at Week 9 action in the NFL.
Starting with the Seahawks, who beat the Commanders on Sunday Night Football 38-14. Technically going in reverse order here, but it's fine. The Seahawks just, I mean, they dominated. This is what they've done all year. Their defense is just way better than anybody really thought it was preseason. And they're getting better because they're getting healthier as the season goes on. But a really scary sight to think about that. Also, no offense, but if you look at Geno Smith and the way he's performing in Oakland, it's a miracle that this team won 10 games last season, even though they missed the playoffs. So, now that they have a competent quarterback, things are looking really, really different in Seattle. I mean, they're one of the best teams in the league at this point, obviously fighting with the Rams still atop that division. Rams also at 6-2 after this weekend, but not going to talk about their game individually because, well, wasn't very close, not worth talking about. But the Chiefs fell at the Bills. They were favored on the road. They had all the momentum heading into this game. 5-3, they had won, I think, three of their last four. But then things just kind of fell apart. Patrick Mahomes didn't throw a touchdown. I was trying to figure out the last time he didn't throw a touchdown pass in a game or run for one. It's been a while, but 232 yards and an interception is his final stat line. Meanwhile, Josh Allen and the Bills just rolling. James Cook, I think they said, was the first 100-yard rusher against the Chiefs defense in like a season and a half or something like that. And then Dalton Kincaid was the first 100-yard receiver against the Chiefs in 13 games. So a lot of records being broken by the Bills offensively. They were really, really smooth, especially in the beginning parts of this game, taking a 28-13 lead in the fourth quarter and then just kind of going into a little bit of a shell, trying to run the ball more, running the clock out, which makes sense. It ended up working. The Chiefs just ran out of time to mount a comeback. But the Bills take advantage of the fact that the Chiefs didn't play their best game and they moved to 6-2 on the season. Still not in first place in their division, though, which we'll get to who is in a second. But speaking of the Raiders, they had a very interesting game this weekend. They came back to tie the game in regulation, send it to overtime. The Jaguars scored a touchdown on their first possession. They kicked the extra point, as any normal team would do. And then the Raiders, because there were only about 20 seconds left on the overtime clock, decided that after they scored their touchdown, they were going to go for two in the win, because for a 2-5 team, it doesn't do much to be 2-5-1 instead of 3-5. So if they're going to do anything this season, they needed that victory, and they didn't get it. The pass was batted down at the line of scrimmage, and the Jaguars instead walk away at 5-3, which means that they're actually still in the playoff picture. Meanwhile, the Chiefs at 5-4 are now actually on the outside looking in, which is pretty crazy to say. But the Chiefs now at the 8 seed, Jacksonville at the final wild card at 5-3 with a win over Kansas City too. So tiebreaker wise, that's pretty important. Actually, both the teams, actually the 5, 6, and 7 teams have tiebreakers over the Chiefs. It's the Bills, the Chargers, and the Jaguars, obviously. Chiefs will play the Chargers again later this season. But for now, they do have the tiebreaker. But moving on from that, speaking of the Broncos are 18, or sorry, they are 7-2 now on the season. I guess I didn't mention them by name, but I mentioned them in thought because I was talking about the AFC West. They won 18-15 this weekend against the Texans on the road. Again, the Texans were favorites in this game. I have no idea why. But you know what? In games where the Texans are favorites and I have, quote, no idea why, they're 1-1. So I guess it maybe makes some sense. But the Broncos scored 11 fourth quarter points. The Texans just can't score in the red zone. They really are super, super, super inefficient at cashing in red zone opportunities with touchdowns. They control the clock. They have long drives down the field. And then when they get in the red zone, they just crumble. They can't move the ball anymore, and they kick a field goal. They attempted 6 field goals in this game. They actually missed one. But still, they only scored on field goals in this game. Meanwhile, the Broncos, just off of 3 scoring possessions, beat the Texans 6 opportunities because Texans only kicked field goals. Broncos had 2 touchdowns, including one that had a 2-point conversion, and then 1 field goal to win the game. So 18-15 is the final score because the Broncos actually convert in the red zone. But moving on from that game, you have a game that definitely didn't come down to red zone execution. It just came down to turnovers. The Steelers beat the Colts. Daniel Jones unearthed his Giants form in this game. I mean, he was a turnover machine in this game, which is something that you can't say about him so far in Indianapolis, but you can say about him in this game. He did end up throwing for 342 yards and a touchdown, and also ran for a touchdown, but he had 3 interceptions and also fumbled the ball 3 times. He only lost 2 of them, but Josh Downs also fumbled one for good measure. So Indianapolis lost 3 fumbles, threw 3 picks, and still only lost by 7, which is pretty ridiculous that they even kept this game close at the end, because basically every possession ended in a turnover or a touchdown for them, which is, you know, I mean, you could say multiple things about that, but literally the first half, their drive chart is touchdown, muffed punt, fumble, interception, punt. So do with that information what you will. They also only punted 1 time in the second half, as well as all the other drives were turnovers, 2 field goals, and some touchdowns. But the Colts, I guess I'd just say when they don't play sloppy, they're going to be fine. This is just a team where the Steelers have a good enough defense to kind of create havoc, turn a team over a lot, and it kind of really, really backfired on the Colts in this matchup where they just couldn't control the clock, couldn't control the ball at all. Just completely backfired on them. And obviously, they're still having a good season, though. They're, of course, at 7-2, atop the AFC, actually, ahead of everybody. But the Steelers, meanwhile, also having a relatively good season. They're actually leading that division because of the slumps of Baltimore and Cincinnati. They are 5-3, but division leaders in the AFC North. And speaking of division leaders, the Patriots lead the AFC East because they are now 7-2. They beat the Falcons 24-23 this weekend to extend their winning streak. This team, they started out 1-2, and since then they haven't lost a game. And it's not like they haven't played, you know, good teams in this stretch. I mean, obviously, you know, the Panthers are decent. They have a winning record on the season. We'll talk about them in a second. The Falcons themselves heading into this game, 3-4, but they had beaten the Bills, and the Patriots themselves did beat the Bills on the road. So they've done the hard work in terms of games in their division. And then we talked about the fact all the way back when they were, I think, 3-2 with the win over the Bills, I said, there's no loss on this schedule until maybe the Falcons game and probably the Buccaneers game. And here we are. They took care of business, 7-2. And now all of a sudden looking like a real, real playoff contender, just in Drake May's second year, with Mike Vrabel's first year at the helm in New England. Then you have the Panthers, who I said I'd talk about later in a second, and here we are. They are 5-4 in the season. They just won 16-13 at the Green Bay Packers. Not hard to imagine, but I guess not something you expected heading into the season was the Panthers going into Lambeau and coming out with a victory. And now with a winning record, still unfortunately not in the playoff picture. They're two spots behind that, as the Lions and the Bears are both 5-3, with the final spot and first spot out of the playoffs. But the Panthers still 5-4, looking pretty good so far this season. Even if they don't make the playoffs, I would just say that, you know, they've shown improvement this season, and that's, I think, one of the most important things. Bryce Young had been healthy all year, they probably could have won an extra game or two anyway. So I think the most important thing, though, was signs of improvement. This is a very, very young team. So if they can keep getting better as the season goes on, then hopefully they can turn into something great in the near future. But for the Packers, they're still leading the division. There's no need to panic here. But at the same time, losing a game at home to the Panthers, when you have the Lions at 5-3 and the Bears at 5-3 right on your neck, and also the Vikings now at 4-4, who we'll talk about their game in a second, but the Lions could be 6-2 this week, and the Packers then would be almost out of the playoff picture themselves. So bad loss for the Packers, great win for the Panthers. And you want to talk about the same concept in a different game. Great win for the Vikings in J.J. McCarthy's return to action. They beat the Lions 27-24 on the road in Ford Field. So talking about that division, had the Lions won this game, they'd be in the lead at 6-2, but they did not. And instead, it's the Vikings who kind of re-enter the playoff discussion here after looking pretty bad in the Carson Wentz portion of the season. But J.J. McCarthy looked decent in this game. I mean, statistically, not the world's, you know, sexiest game. I mean, he had 143 passing yards, but threw two touchdowns and ran for a score as well. And just overall had a solid game, making sure, really just managing the game. I think that's what they want him to be in his first few years. He should just be a game manager, nothing more. Just win the game. You have weapons. You have a decent enough defense. That should be the goal for him. And that is what he has done consistently in his career too, at Michigan, obviously. So hopefully for the Vikings' sake, he can do the same in Minnesota. And so far looking pretty good. Then you have the Bears and the Bengals who played, I don't even know what this game was, but 47-42, the Bears ended up with the win. I don't have words to really describe the back and forth and just ridiculous nature of this game overall. But it was one of the NFL games played this weekend. I can tell you that much. And the Bengals scored a lot and the Bears scored a lot. DJ Moore threw a touchdown in this game, scored one on the ground. Caleb Williams was going off. Colston Loveland ended up with the game winning touchdown, which kind of came out of nowhere because he had frankly had a pretty disappointing season up until that point. So just a lot of stuff going on in this game. But yeah, the Bears end up with the victory in a very, very back and forth, crazy affair. And then finally, going all the way back to Thursday night, you have the Ravens who beat the Dolphins 28-6. Normally wouldn't mention a game like that, but we do have to mention the fact that the Ravens started out the year 2-5 because of the Lamar Jackson injury. And they're just starting to put the pieces together now that he has returned. But they looked really good in his return. Now it's just going to be about how many games in a row can they stack up? Can they be as dominant as they've been in past seasons? Because they really need to if they're going to make the playoffs. But they have the Vikings, the Browns, the Jets, and the Bengals coming up. So, and then the Steelers again, and then the Steelers and the Bengals again. So if you look at those six games, there's a good, I mean, they legitimately could go 6-0 in those games. And they would need to, especially they need to beat the Steelers when they play them, because that's going to be the game that swings the division in their favor.
All right, that wraps up our look at the NFL and obviously our look at football for the week. Let's turn our attention to a couple other sports with first the NBA action with a quick recap of the last week in the National Basketball Association.
Well, I will say this is the first and only basketball segment of the podcast. I did say we'd have college basketball content last week, but then I realized that one game isn't really worth it, especially when there's still World Series action. So to keep the segment amounts even, we're skipping the first day of college basketball, and we'll do the first 8 days of the season next week, which means more basketball talk, which is great. But moving on to the NBA, like you said, we have some surprises atop the East. You have Philadelphia and Chicago both at 5-1. I mean, Chicago had shown flashes of being a great team at the end of last season, but then when it came down to the one-game play-in scenario, it didn't really look like it anymore. So kind of confusing outlook for this season. But Philly, of course, is the team that I think a lot of people are surprised by, because they just flat out were bad last season. Jared McCain hasn't even come back yet. But overall, this team, I mean, they're not even relying on Joel Embiid, and they're still playing fine. Embiid has played in four games, and he started all four, but on a minutes restriction, he's only played 22 minutes per game so far this season. And he's literally being outscored by Quentin Grimes off the bench, who's averaging 18 a game. But speaking of key contributors, though, Quentin Grimes playing very, very well. Then you have Tyrese Maxey, who's averaging 34 a game. I mean, you expect that from Tyrese. But 9 assists, too, which is a shock. And then Vijay Edgecombe, the rookie, averaging 20 points, 5 assists, 5 rebounds per game. So that's what it's going to take for the Sixers to be good this season. I mean, but it's really interesting to think about the fact that Paul George hasn't played a game yet. Joel Embiid has been playing on a minutes restriction. And this team is already at 5-1. So they can get a lot better and a lot scarier as the season goes on with good health. Of course, as much as I hate to say it, they do have some injury-prone players, so it wouldn't be that shocking if this is what happens for the season. But right now, a very, very good guard rotation that's scoring a lot of points. Then for the Bulls, they're also playing very, very well. Like I said, 5-1, kind of a surprise team in the sense that they were in the play-in conversation last year and then didn't even make it to the actual playoffs. But this year, they're kind of carrying that momentum from the end of last season, and it's going pretty well so far. Then you have the Bucks, who are 5-2. Giannis and this team just keep rolling, despite the fact that, you know, this is supposed to be the year where Giannis has almost no support. Doesn't really matter. They're still winning games in a pretty weak East in the first place. Then you have the Pistons, who are also at 5-2, pretty much doing what they did last year. Don't forget that this team ended up, I think, in the fourth or the fifth seed anyway. So this is not like the Pistons aren't a bad team at all. I mean, this is a playoff quality team, especially in a league where two teams that were in the playoffs and in the conference finals last year don't have their guys playing. They don't have their stars. There's no Jason Tatum. There's no Tyrese Haliburton. So I don't know how anybody's going to expect, you know, the Pistons not to be anywhere in the playoff picture, but they're about right where they should be. Then you have the Heat, the Knicks, and the Cavs all at 4-3. Obviously for the Heat, it's a good outcome for them. For the Knicks and the Cavs, a rather pedestrian start to the season, but they'll get better as it goes on. Obviously, the better teams are typically, you know, they're going to take some games, or they're load managing, and they're not really trying as much as some of the other teams that are kind of pressing to break through, make the playoffs, younger teams, obviously. So I'm not worried about the Knicks or the Cavs long term. They're still above 500. Then you have the Raptors, who are 3-4, the Magic, who are 3-4, the Hawks, who are 3-4, and the Hornets, who are 3-4. All those teams stuck in a bunch that currently would be at the bottom of the play-in and the first spot out. Atlanta and Orlando obviously have very big expectations for the year. Toronto and Charlotte, not so much. Then you have the Celtics, who are at 3-5, just trying to stay afloat with no Jason Tatum. Haven't been doing a great job so far, but, you know, they've looked competitive in their games, so we'll see what happens as the season rolls on. But the Pacers, on the other hand, at 1-6, they have really, really struggled without Tyrese Haliburton, which isn't shocking whatsoever because they also lost Miles Turner in the offseason. But this team is just looking like a shell of its former self. I mean, they're down here in the standings with 1-6 Washington. And then, of course, at 0-7, you have the Nets. So not great company to be keeping if you're the Pacers if you're the Pacers, keeping that company with the Wizards and the Nets. But moving on to the West, you have the Thunder, who are 7-0 this season, just doing Thunder things. They're going to be a dominant regular season team. That's what they were last year. That's what they'll continue to be this year. Then you have the Spurs, who are 5-1 on the season, playing great basketball behind the strong play of Victor Wembanyama. And don't forget De'Aaron Fox and Steph Castle as well, who's had a pretty good season so far. Then you have the Lakers, who are at 6-2. This is probably the most shocking team to be tied for second in the standings because LeBron hasn't played a game yet. Luka Doncic missed two games. The Lakers won last night against the Blazers as 10-point underdogs without Luka, Austin Reeves, or LeBron playing in the game. And they still found a way to get a victory. So the Lakers really just dealing with the injuries and just kind of winning games. I mean, at this point, they're going to tell LeBron to take as much time as he wants, get to 100% before he comes back. And frankly, even load manage a little bit when he comes back, because there's no reason to rush him back when they're playing this well not only just without him, but without anybody who's been injured at any point. I mean, Luka obviously has missed those games, like I said, too. So it's pretty crazy what the Lakers have done. Austin Reeves has played great in the absence of both of those two, and Luka has played amazing when he's been healthy as well. Then you have a giant pileup of teams, Denver and Houston, both at 4-2. You expect them to be competing atop these standings. Houston has won 4 in a row after losing their first two games, so they're right back where they want to be, the projected 2 or 1 seed heading into the league, or heading into the year anyway in this league. Then you have Minnesota, Portland, and Golden State all at 4-3 each. I guess Portland would be the surprise team that's somehow like fitting into this group. I didn't think anybody would expect that, especially with the Chauncey Billups controversy and how this season started for them, that they would be this competitive. But here we are. They're playing good basketball, and they're sitting kind of in the middle of the standings. Then you have the Clippers at 3-3, floating off in their own universe there. And then you have Phoenix and Utah at 3-4. Utah had started out the season well, but has kind of fallen off since then. And then Memphis at 3-5, Sacramento and Dallas at 2-5 each, and New Orleans at 0-6 at the bottom of the standings. So I think the bottom of the standings definitely looking like what you'd expect them to look like in the West. But a pretty interesting season so far. Obviously, though, it's still early. A lot can happen in the next few weeks and, of course, the next few months.
All right, that wraps up our look at the NBA. To cap off the podcast, we will talk about the World Series. Frankly, you could probably do a 2-hour or longer podcast on this World Series, particularly the final four games, final five games, but the final four games we're going to talk about right now. So, Patrick, let's talk about the end of this year's World Series.
Well, if it weren't for my obviously ailing voice a little bit, I probably would spend 2 hours talking about this World Series. But we don't have that kind of time on this podcast in the first place. So let's start with this. The Dodgers beat the Blue Jays in 7 games. Where we left off, after an 18-inning victory by the Dodgers. And we're waiting for the rest of the series since then. And I would have to say that it's shocking that the Dodgers ended up taking that 2-1 lead and then actually going to the brink of elimination. There was a legitimate argument that after the Dodgers had won the 2-1, won the game to push the series lead to 2-1, you could argue that it was pretty likely that they just wouldn't stop the momentum there, and they could honestly close the series out at home. That's what they did against the Yankees when they kind of won the games that gave them a lot of momentum. So it wouldn't have been that shocking, but Toronto did a great job of battling back. Great starting pitching. Dodgers hitters just, I mean, they carried over those last 9 innings of game 3, where neither team could score from the 8th until the 17th. They carried that over into game 4 and game 5. Toronto got back on the board easily, but a 6-2 win in game 4, a 6-1 win in game 5. So they had no issues on offense. Obviously, the biggest story in one of those games was the back-to-back home runs to open the game by Davis Schneider and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. off of Blake Snell. I think that was game 5. But that was, you know, a shock to the Dodgers system in a game where they needed a response to send the series back to Toronto with the lead. And then you think, wow, the Dodgers are up against it 3-2 in the series. And all of a sudden, you know, you still have Yamamoto going in game 6 and you feel very, very confident about winning game 6. But then what in the world is going to happen in game 7? Because you probably would use a few guys out of the bullpen in game 6 to make sure you win that game. And then who's available by game 7? Well, as we said on the podcast multiple times, the way the Dodgers won their playoff games was just riding their starters until they couldn't anymore. And that's what they did in game 6 and game 7. Just Yamamoto threw 6 innings of 1-run ball. The Dodgers got just enough runs because they got 3 in the 3rd inning. Got a little bases loaded situation. Will Smith hit a double that helped load the bases. And then Mookie Betts came through with a 2-run single to make it 3-0. And then the Blue Jays only got 1 run back in the whole game. But I mean, the Dodgers winning a game with 3 runs all in 1 inning and 4 total hits was shocking, but that's what they were going to need based on the way the offense was playing throughout the series. That's really what they were going to need to win the series. And then, of course, out of the bullpen, Justin Robleski, former starter, Roky Sasaki, former starter, Tyler Glasnow, the projected game seven starter, actually, which was pretty interesting because this game got dire. Roky Sasaki gave up two base runners to start the bottom of the ninth inning, and it was second and third, no one out. And the Dodgers said, you know what? We got to bite the bullet. We can't just try to stay healthy for game seven. We have to get to game seven first. So even if it means Glasnow can't start game seven, it's time to put him in out of the bullpen. And of course, a three pitch save, which is unbelievable. Three pitches, three outs is hard to do in the first place, but just an insane ending to the game, obviously, with the double play, the line out double play to Kike Hernandez that Miguel Rojas fielded the throw on the bounce off of, and the Dodgers end up winning that game 3-1. And then, of course, in game seven, it was Ohtani against Scherzer. Ohtani just did not have it at all in this game. He was kind of spraying the ball all over the zone. Argument could have been made that he could have been taken out after the first two innings. And then, well, in the third, it did not pay off that he was left in the game. He did not figure it out any better. Gave up a three-run home run to Bo Bichette on, frankly, a pretty terrible pitch. And that's when the Dodgers kind of had to go into panic and scramble mode. But of course, what did they do for the rest of the game? They just put in a bunch of former starters. Justin Robleski, first guy out of the bullpen again. He finished off that inning and then got three more outs as well. But of course, he also started a fight in the middle of all that, which was interesting. But, you know, the Dodgers only got one run back in the fourth. It was 3-1 Toronto. And then Tyler Glasnow came into the game, as we said, the guy who should have started game seven, but only had about 40 pitches in him. He was taken out for Emmett Sheehan. He gave an inning and then he was taken out once he gave up a hit. That's when Blake Snell came in to the game. And then finally, of course, you had the World Series MVP, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who came out of the bullpen to save the day again for the Dodgers. I mean, this is one of the greatest performances by a single player that there's ever been. Shades of Madison Bumgarner back in, what was that, 2015, I think. But look, crazy game because I just went over the pitching plan. I didn't even go over the fact that Toronto led 3-0, as I said. Dodgers made it 3-1. Dodgers made it 3-2 off of another sacrifice fly. So really still no hitting from the Dodgers. They just had sacrifice flies after, you know, a single and a ground out, that type of stuff. Maybe two singles. And then I thought this game really was over when it was 3-2 and Toronto added on immediately after the Dodgers had scored to make it 3-2. They hit two back-to-back doubles to start an inning to make it 4-2 Toronto. And that was when Glasnow was still in the game. But then Max Muncy hit a solo homer in the eighth. And unlikely World Series hero with one out in the top of the ninth, Miguel Rojas homered off of Jeff Hoffman. Jeff Hoffman has given up a ton of home runs all year. I think pretty much, I'm not going to say every run because that's just statistically not possible, but a ton of the runs that he's given up all season have been on the home run ball. That has been his issue all year long. And of course, in the most unlikely of scenarios, the Dodgers get a hit. Really, Max Muncy's home run actually was the hit that guaranteed that Shohei Ohtani would get an at bat. And everybody thought it would come down to that at bat. And of course, that at-bat meant nothing in the game because Miguel Rojas, the nine-hitter before him, who had not played until game six, when Dave Roberts finally decided to shake up the lineup with a struggling Andy Páez. But Rojas came off the bench to start those two games, made a great defensive play in game six, as we mentioned, and then hit the game-tying home run in the ninth inning before, of course, a Will Smith homer in the 11th. That one much more likely candidate to hit a clutch home run. The Dodgers leader all time in walk-off home runs, actually, but with five of them. But Will Smith hit the home run in the 11th inning. Yoshinobu Yamamoto wiggled his way out of a bases-loaded jam at some point and a first and third jam with one out, of course, getting Alejandro Kirk to ground into a double play to end the game. So, I mean, look, there are so many things that you could talk about that I didn't go over, but not enough time in, you know, a 10-minute span to do all that. But just a ridiculous World Series. So many guys you can shout out. Rojas with his, I don't know, David Freese, Stephen Pierce, you could say, moment, something like that. Will Smith, though, he deserves a lot of credit in the series as well. He hit the game-winning home run in this. But not only that, He caught the most innings of any catcher all time in a World Series and still produced at the plate arguably the best of any Dodger in the series, maybe with the exception of Ohtani if you're factoring in some of his better games. But Will Smith was kind of the only consistent hitter the Dodgers had throughout this series. And he also, very importantly, in the first game that the Dodgers won in the series, in game two, had a two-hit game and had three RBIs in that game, including a home run that really won the Dodgers game two. So he essentially won the Dodgers game two and game seven with clutch home runs, and also was just a consistent producer throughout, even in the games that the Dodgers didn't win. So shout out to Will Smith as well. I think he's the guy that kind of went under the radar because people don't value in the defense and managing the staff that whole time as well. But I mean, again, so many ways you can go. Ernie Clement, postseason record for hits, doesn't end up meaning anything. Vladimir Guerrero was second, or I think tied Randy Arozarena's former record for that stat as well. So a lot of playoff performers that did their thing this postseason. But in the end, it's the Dodgers who end up on top and repeat.
Yeah, we could talk about a lot of things, like you said, go on forever. A couple thoughts here before we wrap this up. There were so many players on the Dodgers that if they didn't do one little thing, and we could go into it, they wouldn't have won the World Series, dating back all the way to the start of the Phillies series. In any event, the other thing, other interesting note I saw was that the Dodgers' run differential in the World Series was -8 runs, and I think there's only been three other teams that have won a World Series with that, a -8 run differential or more. So, crazy World Series, great World Series, great for baseball, great for Dodger fans like us. And that was a great way to wrap up the Major League Baseball season for 2025. It's also a great way to wrap up this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, November 11th, where we will once again talk about Patrick's weekend predictions. We will review week 11 of college football and week 10 of the NFL, have another look back at the NBA, and then, as Patrick mentioned, we'll have our first look at college basketball action, which will be the first week plus one day of action. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's picks for next weekend's games, which, as I mentioned, will be posted on Thursday. Also, check out Patrick's preseason bracketology on Monday. All of this on our social media handles at 4th and 24. That's the number 4, THAND, plus the number 24. Thank you for listening.
We know what you're thinking. I just want jeans that look great, feel great, and hold up. At Ariat, we've been doing some thinking, too. We're thinking about fit that moves with you, no matter where the ride takes you. Durability that stands up to hard work, harder play, and comfort that never quits. And all this thinking, it's really just about more living. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat jeans at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.